You're listening to 88.9 FM, KUCI Irvine. The opinions expressed on this program do not reflect the views of KUCI or the University of California, Irvine.
And good morning and welcome to this August 14th, 2019 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org and always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Facebook, also Writers on Writing, KUCI FM. Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website is penonfire.com. Up there are information on speaker series events. There's one great one coming up next week. If you are a fan of Janet Fitch, and a lot of people are, she is going to be at the Pen on Fire speaker series next Tuesday, 7 o'clock, Lido Island Books. If you're in town, sign up early because those seats are limited, and you can go on her website, penonfire.com. My website, mariestone.com, where you can find all of these podcasts. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and we are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft. This morning is all memoir, all morning long, and the interesting thing about both of these memoirs is that they were written pretty proximate in time to the period they cover, which I found interesting. You know, a lot of writers take some years or some decades to process an event. These are processed pretty much in nearly real time. So that is that's kind of interesting. First up, Rick Moody, and in the second half, Alyssa Altman will be here with her memoir, Motherland. Rick Moody is the author of the award-winning memoir, The Black Veil, and the novels Hotels of North America, The Four Fingers of Death, Purple America, The Ice Storm and Garden State, three collections of short fiction, including Demonology. He is the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship and an Arts and Letters Award. His work has been anthologized in Best American Stories, Best American Essays, and the Pushcart Prize Anthology. He writes regularly about music at the Rumpus. He teaches at Brown. And he was on the show with me last October. We talked about all of that stuff. A copy of that podcast can be found in our archives. But that is when I learned about his new memoir, The Long Accomplishment, a memoir of hope and struggle in matrimony, published by Henry Holt. And I promised us both that he would come back on to talk about it. So here he is. Rick, welcome back.
Thanks, Marie.
How's life? Has life gotten better since all this?
Yes. I mean, life is complex, as it has a habit of being. But some of the specifically dark chapters of my marriage that are recounted in the memoir are remediated, I'm happy to say. And so there are ways that things are quite dramatically better. So, you know, life does have a habit of throwing more curveballs.
Always, always, yeah. So we talked last year a little about the memoir and how it was a departure from a lot of your other work and in form and in theme and all that. So it was good to read what we had been hearing about, but I think I hadn't quite appreciated last year what you'd been through. So so it's the story of a very rough year and divorce and marriage and parenting and being an artist in the middle of all that and being a human being in the middle of all that. So maybe you can kind of set the stage for us and take us inside that year just a little bit so that we, you know, kind of have the groundwork to talk about a little.
Sure. So in 2013, I was about, I guess in the beginning of 2013, I was about 20 or more weeks into a collaborative divorce that was going to end my first marriage, at which it's fair to say, and I say in the book, I had done a very bad job. I was not a person who wanted to get married. I only cared really about work and many of the things that are esteemed and held dear in marriage, I utterly neglected, or even worse. And so the end of the marriage was perhaps inevitable, but heartbreaking as they always are. And the divorce was long and difficult. And I was bent on marrying my current wife, Laurel. I had met her about a year before or something. And I was hopeful about it, and I felt like I was finally ready. I was a middle-aged person who had sort of given up on all the sort of bad ideas that had animated me when young, and I really wanted to be married finally, and I was looking forward to it. But then sort of immediately upon finishing up this dreadfully long divorce, I sort of we fell into in the first year of our marriage, this sort of relentless express train of bad luck episodes, among which are sort of deaths among loved ones and extreme illness in the family and aging parents and apartment trouble and infertility of multiple episodes and extreme difficulty, and then some even worse stuff sort of at the end of the year, right around our first anniversary. So the book sort of tries to chart what one does about such things, how marriage can be a support and a tonic and a relief, even in the most sort of absolutely difficult episodes of this kind, and how it's important sort of not to think of the episodes as metaphorical or judgments or karmic repayment for bad stuff that you did when younger or anything else. So that's really what it's about. It's about trying to find some hope in the middle of a very bad streak.
Yeah. At what point did you know you were going to write about this? Was it kind of a foregone conclusion in the middle of it? You knew this was something, it kind of, you know, out of the ordinary that was happening to you that deserved, you know, kind of literary attention? Or did it come about in hindsight and you were like, wow, that was crazy. Should process that.
It's a really good question. And the truth is I was supposed to be doing something else. I got a contract for a book in 2009 for a novel that I was embarked on, but I lost my way in it. I sort of didn't know what I was doing or why I was doing it, and couldn't figure out what I was trying to write about. And partly it was out of exhaustion about fiction, sort of the state of the novel, what I thought about the novel, what was fiction for. I was floundering, really. Yeah. And sort of, I got an idea in the middle of the struggle, which had to do with the fact that Laurel, my wife, is a photographer and was traveling a lot on her visual arts projects. And I traveled along with her for a great deal of it, and I sort of came up with Hotels of North America in that time, which is a book that's really about travel and about hotel life and the sort of picaresque aspect of traveling a lot. But I also realized that all the stuff that was happening to us, the streak of bad luck, was so in my face and commanding in the amount of attention it required that I didn't have room to sort of go back to the novel and do it in the old way, to try to come up with a new piece of fiction. I just couldn't do it. I would have happily done it if it had been easily at hand. But I realized somewhere in there, 2014, 2015, that I just absolutely couldn't do it. The only thing I could do was to try to write about what had been happening, and the impulse was automatic. Hmm. And not in the sense of I have to confess or, you know, I have to get this off my chest, but more that I just don't understand. There's a way that I don't understand what's happening to me psychically, emotionally, unless I try to write it down. It sort of stays as a bunch of waves of feeling and sensation, but not in a way that's sensible unless I commit it to language. Mm-hmm. So when I was trying to figure out what to do after Hotels of North America, there really was no alternative. The material called to me, and it was a way to try to sort of make it sensible somehow.
Yeah. It's really helpful because I talk to a lot of writers about, you know, how do you live in the world? How do you live in the world when life is normal or when the world is normal? But this was really helpful for how do you live in the world as a writer when everything is going to crap, you know? And it is hard to, you know, a lot of people say, oh, you know, if you're going through something really rough, write about it. And a lot of the times, like, that's kind of the last thing a lot of people want to do. They're like, I kind of want to get away from it or I want to break. But in the aftermath, it is kind of the way that people do make sense of what they've been through. And I was wondering if you had to come out of the other side of it to see it with any clarity. Like, it'd be interesting to write this memoir at the time you did, and then, you know, it'd be an interesting long exercise to write it 10 years later to say, or 20 years later to say, how do I now look back on that time period? But the advantage of doing it now is that you just get this really visceral, close, raw, you know, this just happened to me sense of what you'd just been through. I don't know where the
question was. Yeah, you know, this question was dramatized for me at an earlier point when my sister died. There's a book by me of stories called Demonology, and a lot of the stories in that book have one thing or another to do with my sister's death. And it's really interesting, well, for me anyway, but perhaps even for some exegete of short fiction at some point, to sort of chart which story got written at which point on the calendar, because the first story I wrote about it, I wrote 2 months after it happened, a story called Demonology, and it's a real heart-wrencher, a kind of cri de coeur about what it felt like. And then other stories in the collection were written successively at later points, almost out to a couple of years later. And the point of view and the ability to synthesize and think carefully about grief really changes over the period of time.
Yeah.
And at least for me, that process, you know, it's funny that I'm talking about this today because the anniversary, my sister's birthday was 2 days ago. So it's really, mm-hmm. I've been thinking about her again. And that was 24 years ago. But here I am 24 years later, still thinking about it. And I still have a lot to say about that. And so the same is true about this particular series of episodes. I began the book relatively recently, after the sort of calamitous legal entanglement at the end of the book. You know, within 6 months or so, I was starting to try to write it. And then some time passed. I started teaching full time. Things got in the way, and I really finished the book several years later. And in part, I finished it several years later because there's a sort of bit of good news at the very end. And I was waiting for some resolution about that, whether good or bad. Mm-hmm. And that process of waiting was catalytic. It really enabled me to kind of see the book as a whole. It was episodic until I waited a little bit. So now it's 5 years later. You know, the book, the substantial part of the book ends in October of 2014, so that's just about 5 years later. So I do have a little bit distance on the whole thing. But you're absolutely right that if I were to continue to write about it, and I definitely could continue to write about infertility because there's so much to say about it, I'm sure that perspective would alter dramatically the further out I got.
Yeah, right. You didn't say this in the book, but it struck me that, you know, I read it originally as what it was, the memoir, and then I kind of read it as a writerly book, what writers and people trying to study craft could learn from it as well. And, you know, I was thinking of your first marriage and of early writings, you know, that nothing is wasted, right? That bad things sort of pave the path for learning lessons and good writing coming later. And, you know, whatever the pages are that you toss out aren't really tossed out. It's not a waste. And I thought of that kind of in your memoir, that all those years, I mean, obviously your daughter came out of it, which is wonderful, but other wonderful things probably too, that paved the way for what came later. And, you know, if there's some glimmer of hope for writers who are struggling through, nothing is wasted material, right?
Yeah, that's really perceptive. You know, I really feel that way. Obviously, I wrote a lot of stuff in the period of my first marriage, some of which people like a lot, like The Ice Storm and Demonology, you know. Yeah. And it's not that I think I was a complete idiot in those days, although, I mean, the truth, Marie, is that I'm a person with, you know, a gigantic portfolio of problems, and mental illness is among the problems, you know. And so it would be easy for me to feel retributive and mad about my behavior, and sometimes I can really get into that rut, you know. But I think it's also helpful to take a big step back when looking at artists and their careers and see how all these little byways do provide the raw material and the fodder and the pathway through which one gets to the present. And I feel like I've had a big, in the last 2 years, let's say, I think I talked with you about this last time we talked, but sort of a big crisis about what I feel about some of the sort of large-scale implications of postmodernism and experimental writing, and the role that realism can play in writing. And in part, the long accomplishment, the book, is an attempt to solve discomfort. And what you say about craft is really interesting to me, because there's a way that in making this book, I felt like crafting excessively was at the opposite end of the dialectic from candor. As I was trying harder to tell the truth, some of the kind of punctilious craft orientation that's characterized my work in the past fell away a little bit. To me, it's slightly sloppier than other things I've written, but it's more emotionally accessible somehow. And so those two things, maybe for this writer, are antithetical or at least diametrically opposed in some way.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Yeah, that's interesting. That's interesting. I also really enjoyed the discussion between photography and writing. So your wife is a photographer, and my husband's also a photographer, and we just have all these, we don't collaborate on anything, but we have all these kind of interesting conversations about the lens through which you see the world and, you know, kind of the voice in photography and themes and all of those things. And it just added such a nice texture, kind of across art and, you know, what we have more in common with other artists, even if we're dealing with the world in totally different ways. And you both obviously come at it in kind of seemingly like totally different ways, but the synergy is really interesting to me. That must be fun. Is it fun?
Yeah. I mean, because of it, also my late sister took pictures, and photography's been something that I've sort of collided with and felt influenced by at many points in my life. And because of Laurel, who was really educated in it, you know, she went to the Yale School of Art and everything, the hotbed of American photography in the last 20 years, I've learned a ton. And I do feel like photography and writing are much more closely allied than people often give them credit for being. Photography seems so singular in a way, and its reputation for being a documentary form or having a documentary impulse sort of leads people to feel like it couldn't consistently share terrain with literature. But then you have all this stuff like, you know, Claudia Rankine's Citizen that has the photographs in it, and W.G. Zabel's work, and more poetry writers are using photographs, and essayists are using photographs, and it seems like there really is shared terrain there. And so the idea that Laurel and I are working in media that are at some distance from one another, that doesn't seem supportable. To me, they seem very close some of the time. And in her case, because she studied a lot of writing and took workshops, she took poetry writing with Deborah Diggs at Tufts, she took fiction writing with Robert Stone at Yale, she really knows about writing. So the language through which we might have a conversation when we do is, you know, porous and easy, and it's enabled me to feel very close to that photographic impulse. And this book probably reflects some of that.
Did she ever have any impulse to process this year through kind of her own photographic lens? Like at certain points I was like, because the cover has photographs of the two of you, I was like, oh, it'd be kind of interesting to see what her, you know, if she documented any, some, you know, some of these moments. I don't know if that was ever a discussion.
Well, that's like the $100,000 question. I mean, the book goes at some length into ways that we influence each other, which are oblique. Yep. There's, I think, very strong influence between us and our work, but it's not sort of rhetorically heavy. I never say, you ought to take pictures of this, and she never says, why don't you write a book about this? Those conversations never happen.
Yep.
But it's more that there's some kind of way that our unconsciousnesses sort of reprocess things that the other has done and refract them or sort of include them in impulses. And the really good example that I use in the book is when I was on tour for Four Fingers of Death paperback, Laurel came on some tour dates with me, because it was just when we were just first dating and stuff. And I was reading every night this passage from Four Fingers of Death about the night sky and the desert. It's sort of a two-page passage in that book. And so I read it in Tucson. We were in Tucson, and I read that passage. And then she and I went up into the hills, and she was taking these photographs in the hills above Tucson using just a flashlight and sort of available night light. And it was sort of very much an homage to the passage from the book. Hmm. And it then became this technique, this available light technique, became the basis for the project that she did next. It wasn't about the night sky in the same way. It wasn't about the desert, but it used this technique that had sort of been generated on that trip. So that's kind of the way the influence works, you know. Mm-hmm. And it would be great, and I think it would have made the book really interesting if I could have compelled Laurel in some way to be a equal contributor to it. Right. And there was a moment in the process when I wanted her to write an appendix. And I had sort of borrowed the idea from Diego Rivera's autobiography. Did you ever read that? It's
no.
Really great.
Okay.
Huh. But there are three appendices in it by women that Rivera was involved with, including Frida Kahlo, where they get to sort of, you know, think on what he said in the book. And they're fascinating. Hmm. It's such a fascinating decision. Are you there?
Yeah, me? Yeah.
A what? Fascinating decision from the point of view of book structure to include these appendices. So I asked Laurel if she would consider doing it. And she did for a while, but the fact of the matter is that for her, writing is fairly arduous, and that when she does it now, you know, she sort of has to think about it for a year, and then she gets, you know, 3 to 5 pages out of it. It's not an easy process for her the way it is for me. And so the idea fell away at a certain point as logistically impractical with where we are now. But I think it's a foregone conclusion and given that at some point she will tackle the material and it'll be her version of the story. And, you know, then if people are still interested and they want to compare the two, they will get a chance.
That is really interesting. And I think it's always interesting in memoir to, you know, how you deal with the living and how you deal with the dead and who gets a say in anything and, you know, who gets to comment and who you listen to. And I guess the answer usually is nobody. You just listen to yourself and you write the story as it happened to you. And, you know, they have their own versions of it, but that's not for your memoir to tackle. I don't know if that's how you felt about it. You know, if you treated the living in the book different than you treated the dead, or if you took anybody else's, thoughts or viewpoints into account.
Well, I always do that now, in the sense that I only want to use my powers for good, you know, and so there's never an axe to grind for me in trying to do this work, or maybe the only axe that gets ground is the one that I use on myself, you know. Mm-hmm. But everybody else, life is too short, and the only thing that I want to do is sort of celebrate what love there has been and the loyalty of loved ones and so on. And so I went on it that way, but there were definitely moments, you know, when there was material that I didn't feel belonged to me. For example, really the trickiest thing in the entire book from my point of view, was writing about Laurel's mom. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, at a certain point, I had to just default because I know that that material is very important to Laurel. And in fact, the first show that she did while I was writing the book was a show that had several dozen sort of composite portraits of her mother. Really remarkable photographs, actually. Mm. And I think that show definitely was sort of bouncing off of things that were happening for me in trying to write the book. So there was material where it was very obvious to me that I don't have joint ownership of Mary Mercadante's life. I'm just one guy who was there toward the end of her life and who saw some things. But I didn't want to poach on Laurel, and I didn't want to poach on Laurel's brothers, mm-hmm. you know. So that was a subject that was very loaded, and in the galley stage, you know, Laurel really wanted to read closely and sort of ask for cuts if there was material that she felt strongly about using at some later point. And she was fully involved in that in the proof stage. Mm-hmm. So that's where that stuff came up. It's funny, you know, in the public response to the book that the flashpoint is whether it's all right for me to write about infertility as the male partner in this infertile couple. And for me and for us, expressly from Laurel's point of view, that was never a problematic aspect of the work in any way. Laurel thinks, I think she would completely come and say this on the phone if she were standing near here, that, you know, the idea that a male partner in an infertile couple is not, you know, a part owner of the narrative of infertility is sexist. That's her position.
Right.
That's the word that she uses. So I didn't worry about that part, and I did it in the hopes that I was doing justice to some of how Laurel felt about it. But as I say, the real issue was not that in the composition. It was doing justice to Laurel's family.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. My guest this morning is Rick Moody. We are talking about The Long Accomplishment, a memoir of hope and struggle in matrimony. I also like that there's this I don't know if it's called an organizing principle, but sort of this theme that is threaded throughout of this Charles Manson postcard. And the possession of the postcard and eventually the disposition of the postcard. And it's narratively wonderful. And, you know, it's so rare that life happens narratively wonderfully, and it's the writer's job, I suppose, to then go back and look at a piece of what life has given you and make sense of it. And that postcard felt like one of those events. I don't know if it feels like that in the living through it, or if it feels like that, if that's one of those nuggets that you can only find in hindsight. But can you talk a little bit about that through thread and whether that was there from the beginning or whether that was kind of discovered along the way?
Yeah, sure. The Manson postcard was something, and especially in this Manson-rich environment we're in right now, was something that Laurel and I talked about all the time. And it was something that we joked about all the time. My God, maybe this Manson postcard is causing all of this, you know? And we discounted that, as one would if one's, you know, a rationalist about this stuff. But it didn't change the fact that increasingly I felt really uncomfortable about having the Manson postcard, which, you know, I should say for people who haven't read the book, I commanded through a series of trades with people for various things. And I got it from a guy who himself had had horrible luck while in possession of the Charles Manson signature. And who joked to me upon giving it to me that he hoped that the curse wouldn't obtain in our case too. And then it went and obtained, you know, by a power of 10 for a while. So we joked about it. And then at a certain point after joking about it for a while, we really did say, we've got to get rid of this. So it was there at an early stage in the composition, to answer your question, and was something that I understood to be a sort of reiterative, orienting narrative that would sort of ground the reader as a series of refrains or callbacks throughout the whole.
Plus, when you see Charles Manson's name, it just lights up, you know. You can't,
yeah.
You can't look away.
Like a... Yeah,
exactly. The other thing that I wanted to talk about was this different ways that you feed your creativity, but there was this great section on the audit, this thing called the Odyssey Works, which you can describe way better than I can, but it reminded me of that old Michael Douglas film, The Game, except it wasn't nearly as sinister as that old movie. But anyway, talk about Odyssey Works for a moment, if you will, and then we can talk about some of the other creative things that you've done to sort of feed your artistic life.
So the Odyssey Works is basically a theatrical presentation that's tailored to and made for an audience of one person. So if Odyssey Works accepts you, you know, which they only do a couple of times a year, they create this whole narrative, and then they ask you to set aside some time, and they sort of present it to you, and you become, in a way, integrated into their odd, uncanny, and slightly invasive, but maybe in a good way, work that they do. And in my case, I was accepted, and this was in the summer of 2013. In my case, they really put a lot of work into it. I think they got a big grant, and they wanted to sort of increase the scale of the project and see what would happen. So it sort of ran on and off for several months, a couple of months plus a few days here or there. And it's sort of hard to describe in a brief way, but I would say, if I were to try to digest, that how it works is small aspects of your life become real estate that they commandeer and change slightly. So say you're in a bank line and a guy starts talking to you and he seems to know a few things about you, and you have this weird, overly intimate conversation with this guy, and you walk away going, I wonder what was that about? Why did I have this conversation? It's like that, but it happens again and again in sort of increasingly strange ways over a period of time. And so that was sort of the project. There's a lot in it that I haven't mentioned here. The passage in the book has to do with my being kidnapped and flown to Saskatchewan for the night. The net effect of it is to make you pay attention better.
Yeah.
That's the effect of Odyssey Works. It makes you pay attention to life and to look at what you would look at events that you would normally throw away, like the bank line. Well, I've got to be in this bank line for 10 minutes. I don't want to be in it. Odyssey Works causes you to look even at that and to think, this is a glorious experience of being. So for me, it had great value because it did that, and that allowed me to sort of think clearly in my work for a little while.
It's the coolest thing ever. I was totally taken by it. But you also had done some, I mean, it sounds like you did Burning Man for the Four Fingers of Death, and you did vocal training workshops. It's just I think it's just a cool reminder, not to just writers, to anybody. I mean, not even just artists, but just to get out of your comfort zone and look at life, as you say, with kind of renewed eyes. And I don't know if you have to push yourself to make, like, it would take a lot to drag me to Burning Man, because I feel like I just wouldn't love it. But the whirling dervish in here, you know, one of your friends just studied to be a whirling dervish. I don't know, just taking huge risks of creative jumps that, God, that's got to feed you for a lifetime.
I mean, all the things you've referred to are things that I consider to be among the most vital of my creative time. My taking vocal training with Meredith Monk is one of the best things I ever did in my life. I still feel that way, and I feel like those days that I was in and around her sphere of influence made me a better writer, made me a better person, made me feel more alive, and so on. And I wouldn't trade any of that in. It's funny, in the book, Laurel took an instant dislike to the Odyssey Works thing, even though she liked Abe, the guy who does it, who's the sort of ringmaster. She likes him, as do I. She kind of hated the tone of the whole thing, and it's just grinding resistance for her about it. And I sort of had to say, I know this is not a thing that you would do, but maybe you can just chalk it up to something that I'm doing to sort of re-energize and reconfigure myself creatively. And she was eventually fine with that. Everyone gets to make their own version of this. What does off balance feel like for you? What does it feel like for me? It's not the same in everyone's case at all. But for me, these were examples of trying to do that, just get me to a place where I have no kind of cynical, pre-formulated opinion, and I've got to experience anew.
Yeah, yeah. Did the book change your mind about anything? Like, after either during the writing process or after it was done, did you look back at that year in a way that you hadn't looked at it when you were living through it, or in the brief aftermath of it? Like, did the writing of it change something about it?
You know what really was hard? I mean, the writing was hard in various spots. Memoirs harder for me than fiction. Truth-telling, I find I have, occasionally I block when I'm trying to tell the truth, and I just don't want to do it. So there's that. But what was really illuminating for me was I read the audiobook this time. So I guess it's about 3 months ago or so, I went into the studio and I had to read the entire thing. And that's when I sort of really understood the sort of instinctual ideas of the book in a much clearer way than I had when writing them. I think the writing part is, at this point, an automatic impulse. And it's helpful, and I learn. But I sort of can't see the global effect of the book all the time. I have to get some distance on it. And the reading aloud thing was extremely challenging and heartrending, you know. And especially with infertility, there's a way, and I think this is true for Laurel too, there's a way that I sort of carved up the horror of it into interstitial segments. And I never thought about it as a whole or very infrequently. You know, I would say to someone else, oh, this is happening to us. And, you know, I knew all the things that one says, but to what extent was I really feeling it and really seeing it? I think now I can kind of see that and see, you know, that for us, it's really easy for me to see other couples who've had even harder, more difficult times than we had, and to feel great sympathy and compassion for them, but harder for me to sort of see it for us. But now I'm starting, and I did with the reading the audiobook, start to see the sort of expanse and what a difficulty it was over the course of months and months and months.
Well, it's, I mean, it's such a PTSD sort of experience, right, that you probably don't take it in while you're living through it because you couldn't, and
and truly is, you know, truly is far worse for the women in this process than for the men, but that doesn't mean that it's not PTSD for me too. You know what?
Yeah, right.
You know, when I think back on our twin boys, you know, like it's still pretty painful.
Right.
So the one way we survived it, as I say, was to kind of carve it up into little moments and not look at it closely.
Yeah. So your point about the hardest part of memoir is telling the truth, which is true, I think, for any memoirist. How do you know, as a writer, that you've told enough of the truth? Like, because I feel like a lot of people working on memoirs hold back, and you'll say you've got to go deeper, and they're like, "Well, this is deep. This is as deep as it goes." And I mean, you've written for forever and ever, and you're the master at it, but how do you kind of psychologically know that you have gone deep enough that you are telling the truth? Like, are there little indicators to yourself that, okay, this is, you know, I've finally gotten to it and I'm not tricking myself and I'm not lying to myself anymore?
That's a pretty heavy, deep question. I mean, in a way, this book comes out of a feeling of having withheld stuff in the Black Veil and feeling, even though there are a lot of passages in Black Veil, a lot of Black Veil, my earlier memoir is about being in the psychiatric hospital, and I feel like nowadays if I want to try to remember what happened there, I have to go look in the book, because I did a really good job, I think, in the book of preserving all that material. But there are ways for me at that time that the memoir was such an uncomfortable form as a fiction writer that I found myself resisting now and again, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And this book, I think, from a procedural standpoint, doesn't have that problem. I just kind of told as much truth as I could, and then I shaped it slightly. You know, I cut some stuff just because how much can the reader take? But it's the truth as well as I can tell the truth, and at this point in my later 50s, I feel like I've gotten a lot closer to sort of not wanting to massage the thing to make me look better. I don't think I would do that in the same way as when I was younger.
Yeah. So good. Well, we covered a lot. Are there things we should have covered that we didn't cover? Stuff you like to talk about that we didn't get to talk about. It's good stuff.
I can't think anything.
Yeah. Is there advice you give to students working on memoir? I don't know how much you teach the memoir form versus the fiction form, but, or if, you know, teacherly advice that you, the professorly advice that you give out on memoir.
I haven't done it that much. And it's funny, I wrote a catalog essay for a painter friend of mine just recently. And she was at Brown when I was there as an undergrad, and took class with this writer, somebody I really love and admire now, Mary Caponegro. Mm. And And my painter friend was writing about this episode from her high school years. And she said that Mary, she still remembered the exact wording of this piece of advice that Mary had given her, which was, excavate the memory entirely. And I feel like that's sort of the most compacted version of what I would suggest for memoirists, period, which is that the job is to take this memory and store it somewhere, you know? So don't be overly concerned with the methodology or the apparatus right now. The goal is to preserve the memory. And so that means take a big step back and look at it and not worry about who the protagonists are, but try and get the whole thing down. That's what I try to do this time, is just get it all down, however it is.
That's great. Rick Moody, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Marie. I appreciate it.
That's great. We are going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Alyssa Altman will join me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Facebook, also Writers on Writing, KUCI FM. Barbara's website, again, is Pen on Fire. Mine, again, is Marie, M-A-R-R-I-E, stone.com. And I am here with intern Naomi. Naomi, say hello.
Hi.
So we are here now with Alyssa Altman. She is the critically acclaimed author of Poor Man's Feast, A Love Story of Comfort, Desire, and the Art of Simple Cooking, and the James Beard Award-winning blog of the same name. And Trefi, Triafi, I'm gonna talk to Alyssa about how to pronounce that. I was struggling with that. My Life is an Unorthodox Outlaw. Her work has appeared in O, the Oprah Magazine, the Wall Street Journal, the Guardian, the New York Times, Tin House, on and on. The Washington Post, where her column Feeding My Mother ran for a year. Alyssa's work has been anthologized in Best Food Writing 6 times. The finalist for the Frank McCourt Memoir Prize. She has taught the craft of memoir at the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown, the Loft Literary Center, 1440 Multiversity, and Ireland's Literature and Larder Program. She's appeared live on stage at TEDx, a wonderful talk she gave about her mother and aging, the public on Heritage Radio, and widely on NPR. Her latest, Motherland, a memoir of love, loathing, and longing, published by Ballantine Books, is the subject of our chat this morning. Alyssa, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, I knew the moment I picked this book up, Motherland, Love, Loathing, and Longing, it would be undeniably specific and absolutely universal and relatable. So I called you immediately.
Thank you.
So was your mother always a subject and a person you knew you were going to write about?
Yes. You know, I believe, you know, there's a very famous James Baldwin quote about how writers generally have one subject that they write about, and they write about it over and over and over again in different ways and different forms, and it becomes clearer and tighter. And my mother has been a creative lightning rod for me from as far back as I can remember, and I always knew that at some point she was going to be the focal point of a book.
And no wonder that she is. Well, I guess before we get out, before over our skis too far, we should set the groundwork a little bit for the book for people who haven't yet read it. And I'll kind of let you set the stage for Motherland and a little bit of the landscape of the relationship you have with your mom.
Sure. Well, my mom and I have, I think that the best way to start is to say, and this kind of sets everything up in a nutshell, my mother did not know that she was pregnant with me for 6 months. How is this possible? No idea. But she did not know. And so, you know, there I was, and I think that kind of set up our relationship as being one of not enmity, but just always at odds, always kind of surprised by each other. We are as different from each other as night and day. We look different. We see the world through a different lens. And she is this sort of hyper heterosexual glam queen, makeup loving fashionista type person, and I'm not any of those things. And it's always been, you know, it's always been challenging. It's always been difficult. I do not have any siblings, she. Our relationship has been cantankerous at best, and I left New York City, where I was born and raised and where she still lives, about 20 years ago to basically save myself. I mean, ostensibly I had fallen in love with someone who lived outside of New York. And so, like the old television show Green Acres, I left New York City and lived there with my partner of 20 years, and where I live now. And a few years ago, my mother suffered a catastrophic accident, and I was called back into the fray in New York to take care of her and to be her caregiver and to unravel not only the practicalities surrounding being a caregiver for a difficult older parent, but to unravel our own story and make sense of it.
Right, right. It's. I was talking to Rick Moody in the first half hour, and I thought it was interesting that both of these memoirs tackle a subject matter pretty close, you know, in proximate time. I mean, and your situation with your mom is still, I imagine, ongoing. She's still alive.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I think it's always interesting to look at memoir when you've had, you know, 10 years to digest it, like how you would write about an event if it was, you know, 20 years in the past or 10 years in the past versus how you write about it when you're still kind of right in the middle of it. And
yes.
You're even more in the middle of it than he was writing about 2013 or 14. And I was just kind of wondering what that experience is like when, because it gives it such a, I mean, a lot of this is backstory, but it also, you know, is so visceral and raw and here and now. And if you have a different relationship with the material when you're in it versus when you're, you know, when it's behind you a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, I have said, and I say I actually just finished teaching a memoir class at Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown in July, and one of the things we talked about is the act of writing a memoir from the center of the story while it is unfolding in real time, and that it is sort of lotus-like. It opens, the story opens up, and for that to happen, the author, the writer, needs to take a giant step back and let that unfold and create a narrator who is a character in the story, who obviously represents the author, but a narrator who interacts in the story. And that was something that I had to do. I had to take a giant step back. In the afterword of the story, I actually say that this was not the book, that it was not the story that I expected to write when I sat down to write it. I didn't know how it was going to unfold. I certainly thought that there was going to be more food in it. My background is historically as a food writer, but really what it was about ultimately was about nurturing and sustenance, and how can a mother and daughter nurture and sustain each other when their relationship has been frayed and severed over the years. Caregiving is certainly a big part of it and a big part of the story, but it's not, you know, it's not all of the story. I was very surprised when the story was written, when the book was, when the manuscript was finished, that there was a lot more love in it, quite frankly. Having read it several times and going through the editorial process, there was I could see that there was so much more love in it between these two people, the narrator and my mother. I have spent most of my life with people who know the two of us and who have seen the two of us live together, saying to me, why don't you just leave? Why don't you turn around and just leave and never come back and not put up with the shenanigans and the difficulties and the financial obligations and the various sort of emotional cruelties? And the reason why made itself very clear. I could never answer that question until the book was finished. And the reason why was because we absolutely love each other. We're also codependent on each other and enmeshed, and that's a whole other side of the story. But we there's a profound amount of love and affection between myself and my mother.
I'm glad you said that, because I am always curious about what just the writing of the book reveals to, especially in memoir, what the writing of the book reveals to the writer. And it sounds like this really clarified and crystallized for you what the relationship has always been, in a way that if you were just living through it, maybe it wasn't something you could see. I mean, not that writing is therapy, but it also is a kind of a way to wrap your arms and understand a relationship in a way that you probably wouldn't if you didn't force yourself through the act of, you know, putting a narrative structure around it and calling up all of these memories and all the other stuff that goes along with writing a memoir.
Yes, yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that, you know, it was the great memoirist Danny Shapiro who says that, that, you know, we write memoir to make meaning. We try to make meaning of our stories. And I have always said that in a memoir, the difference between memoir and autobiography is that memoir is a sliver of time, a curated sliver of time. And so in those two things, those two components together, I certainly did not, I could not make any real statement about who my mother and I were together while the story was unfolding. It was only when the story was completed and the book was completed that I was able to really look back at it and have it really be crystallized for me, as you say, and really clear to me that we are we are profoundly connected to each other.
It's funny because Rick Moody in the first half hour said it wasn't until he was reading the audiobook for, you know, everything was done and it was out. And now he's the reader of the audiobook. And he's like, it wasn't until I was reading it out loud that I really understood what had happened. You know, that.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I did the same thing, and I had a really wonderful and kind producer and director of my audiobook. And I spent 2 days reading this story of these two people, and when you do that as a narrator, and I'm sure that Rick would probably agree that it pulls you, just the act of doing that pulls you out of the center of the story, and you become this sort of narratorial observer of the story. And he's absolutely right. That was also the moment for me when I realized and how much love there was and how clear that was.
I also, you know, I also love what you said about food and being a food writer and how you thought this book would be much more food centric than maybe it turned out to be, but not to stick all of us on the therapist couch right now. But I feel like if you look up either food or mothering in the thesaurus, it's probably going to reference the other one. I mean, I just feel like mothering and food are so intertwined, whether, you know, whatever that means.
Sure.
They're so
sure. I mean, when you know, when you make sourdough bread, you know, the sourdough starter, it's with bread, it's called a starter. And when you make it, when you make a vinegar, it's called a mother. Mm-hmm. And I was once gifted a piece of to put it in the weirdest way possible, a piece of Paula Wolfert's mother. Paula had made a red wine vinegar years and years and years ago, and a piece of the mother from that vinegar found its way down to me. And so I always have those references stuck sort of in the back of my head. And there is a definition of mother, culinary and other, and not at that opens motherland, which decorum and the FCC prevent me from reading here.
That's great. My guest this morning is Alyssa Altman. The book, Motherland, A Memoir of Love, Loathing, and Longing. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I also feel like writing is, especially a book like this, is a way of sort of preserving yourself in your story. Your mother is such a, you know, she's like the gravity of the sun or something, where she just keeps pulling people in, you know, and I was thinking of this as almost like a document to preserve yourself, you know, that this is a way for you to say, this is who I am. This is sort of evidence that that I exist separate and apart from my mother. And I don't know if it gave you, I always want to talk about, you know, the difference between therapy versus writing that is publishable writing. But in this case, it does feel like it would be very self-affirming or something to have this book that you can point to. This is me, and you know, you are you, and I am me. I don't know if I'm making any sense here, but
yeah, no, you are, and I think that I think that memoir does that. Generally speaking, when someone sits down to write. A story in which they are a character from, and it's written from their point of view. I mean, it automatically, I think, sets the writer apart as narrator, and as character. And I think it must. I think it has to. And just the doing of that, and the fact of that, allows the writer to, certainly in a situation like this where they're a mother, you know, there's a mother and daughter tightly enmeshed, tightly codependent, and that's the story. That's the core of the story. The narrator has to step outside of that in order to see that, in order to see that story. And there's no other way to do that than to do that from a point of view of observer. And when you're an observer, you are automatically set apart. You know, there were many instances in the book, in the story itself, where the fact of me as a separate person is an issue in those actual words. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, when I came out, my father said to me, "You're going to have to tell your mother that you've come out, because she will understand then that you are a separate and different person from her." My mother, as you said, has a gravitational pull. She's highly, highly seductive in many ways. As I just described our relationship, I just described her in a recent conversation as being sort of like a centrifuge. And the story is being sort of like a centrifuge. That's the level of the force. That's when people get pulled into her universe. It's very, very hard to extricate oneself. Certainly as a daughter, and certainly as a daughter charged with her care. And that is an element of the story.
With that being said, and with her still alive, was she kind of omnipresent in your head as you're sitting at the screen trying to get these down? And what will she think of this? And what will she say? And how will she process this if she reads it at all? Or is she just happy she's being written about?
Yeah. You know, my mother has NPD. My mother has narcissistic personality disorder. And my mother honestly believes that all publicity is good publicity. And she believes that. And that's fine. She, when I was writing the Washington Post column, she read every one of the columns and took issue with only one fact that turned her upside down, and that was the fact that the paper revealed her age, and that was it. She is aware of the fact that, you know, we have not had a great relationship, and she is also aware of the fact that. we love each other, and that if I didn't love her to the degree that I do, I probably would have been long gone. She has been very, very generous. She's been spiritually generous and emotionally generous. She'd like to say that it's her biography, which is not true, but she's actually reading it as we speak, and has been, you know, knock wood, she's been very supportive of it.
That's so funny, because before we went on the air, I was talking with my intern about the book, and I said, you know, that I was going to ask something around that question. And I said, mark my words, she's going to say, all publicity is good publicity. Her mom is going to love that she was written about.
Well, you were on target.
That's great. So I wonder if we can spend our last few minutes together, sort of the Alyssa Altman memoir class, and sort of how you teach memoir. If you have a student that's approaching the memoir, sort of how you guide them to organize the material. Is it journaling? Is it using photographs? Is it kind of, for people who are sitting down and trying to tackle the memoir form, first maybe tips on just how to wrap your mind around the material and, you know, kind of where to begin to wrangle the story in.
I think that the biggest issue that a lot of new writers face is new writers with memoir face is overwhelm. There's emotional overwhelm. There's content overwhelm. There is timeline overwhelm. A lot of new writers don't know where to start, when to start, how to start. There are issues of point of view. There are issues of voice. Which is an issue that I have my students focus on later in the process. There are certainly issues of permission and story ownership. A lot of my students come to me and say, I don't feel like I have the right to write my own story. That's a very big one, and that in and of itself can cause all sorts of hurdles and roadblocks and writer's block and things like that. And so what I ask my students to do is I have them do a series of short exercises, which I think time would prevent me from getting into in any great detail. Short exercises that are meant to take writers out of their head and get them down, get their words down on to the page. A moving pen is a good place to start. I mean, Julia Cameron absolutely has that right. I think she is a godsend for a lot of new writers. So getting the pen moving, starting small, starting in a scene, with one situation rather than one big story. That's overwhelming. In AA they talk about, day by day, take it one day at a time. Same thing with the writing practice. Start small, think of it as just, one situation, one scene at a time. And that usually is a way for new writers of memoir to free themselves up. I also give my students exercises that involve a change of tense, a change of which automatically inevitably changes the voice. And that is very freeing, to write something in the present active tense where it's been written, where it came out of the past tense, allows for a certain level of immediacy. And that can put the new writer down right into the center of the action. And that often gets the pen to move, a bit faster. Those are good places to start. I have often said, I just taught this in a class recently, that journaling and memoir are two completely different things. Mm. You know, memoir is crafted sliver of time, a crafted, curated sliver of time, and journaling is not. Journaling very often should never leave the journal, certainly.
Right.
Always writing, always reading, those things are very, very important. Putting down digital tools, putting down the iPhone, putting down the, you know, I don't want to say the iPhone, but putting down the cell phone, putting down the smartphone, putting down, stepping away from the, you know, the iPad, and picking up, paper and reading, and slowing down creatively. Those things are, I think, very, very important for the new writer.
So true. So true. God, this was great. This was great. We need another hour to keep talking.
That sounds great.
I know. Where can we follow you online and find more about you?
I am on, I have a website, alyssaaltman.com. All of my upcoming events are there. I am very active on social media. So as I just said, put the phone down, but I'm very active on social media. You can find me on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, love to talk to readers and new writers. So I look forward to it.
Love it. Love it. Alyssa Altman, thank you so much. This was great.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks again. That was Alyssa Altman, the book Motherland, a memoir of love, loathing, and longing, available at all your favorite indie bookstores and elsewhere, but really go to your indie bookstores, that's better. That's all the time we have for this week. Next week, I'll be back doing all short stories all the time. Peter Orner and Ben Marcus will be on. In the meantime, stay tuned for Rock Coaster, some great tunes coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great, great day.